Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking real estate fire with Alan Corey.
Yeah, so any longtime listener of the podcast knows that we're fans of investing in real estate. We both have a handful of rentals, and a decent bit of our financial success is because of those properties, because of those houses. But we also approach the conversation with a degree of reservation because we don't think it's for everyone, first of all. But also, we got into the market at a historically great period of time. And so we're nuanced when we talk about real estate, but our guest today is not. And so here to preach the real estate gospel is Alan Corey, who is all in. He's a realtor. He's author of House Fire, which we'll be discussing today. And of course, he is an investor himself. Alan is a self-proclaimed real estate maximalist here in our wonderful city of Atlanta. And we're going to talk about all things real estate. I also heard that he wanted to be a stand-up comedian in a previous life, Joel, so maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. But Alan, we really appreciate you joining us on the podcast today.
Glad to be here. You're right. Real estate's not for everyone. It's only for people who want to make a lot of money.
There's the first burn.
He's already making us laugh. He really was a stand-up comedian. I can tell. Alan, the first question we ask everyone who comes on the show, Matt and I, we splurge a lot on craft beer. Even while we're being intentional, we're saving and investing for our futures. What's that for you? What do you like to splurge on?
It used to be craft beer, and then I turned 40, and then my gut was telling me that I can't have IPAs anymore. And at about that time, I got really into flat caps, which are basically the hats that Sherlock Holmes wears. And the only reason I'm fighting every urge, but when you hit about 45, which is my age now, you start turning into your father. And it's just genetically predisposed that I'm going to wear these hats that he wears, what my grandfather wear, and my great-grandfather. I don't know what it is. I just can't stop buying them. And my wife is going crazy that our closet's getting filled with these caps. I end up buying one a month
Tweed and stuff? I'm guessing they look cool.
You get the plaid, you get the tartan, you get the tweed, you get the St. Patrick's themed one, you get there's a new holiday, I need a new cap, and my wife's like, you look 40 years older when you wear that, and I know I do. It's just I cannot stop myself. I don't know what's going on.
I thought the direction you're going with it, I thought you were going to start talking, you're going to mention hair loss or something.
Covering
like
something
that.
Up. That's
yeah,
what I thought.
Yeah. But you're saying that just truly it's in your DNA, not that you're going to lose your hair, but that you are turning into your father and your grandfather.
Yeah. And my dad's really into the ancestry and genealogy, and we're from Ireland and Scotland and England, but we've been in America as far as we can trace it back for over 200 years. I just can't shake this flat cap thing, and it's all my ads on every social media. They know that this is my weakness, and that's the only ad I get, and I just keep buying them. So
I just hope you're sitting on the front porch smoking a pipe on a rocking chair, also telling the kids to get off your lawn while you're wearing it.
Yes, then I've metamorphed into my dad, and that's the trifecta. Cycle continues to my son.
I feel like there's a way you could kind of change the script and what people expect, Alan, as long as you're not walking like clasping your hands behind your back while you shuffle down the sidewalk. Because if you do that, it reinforces the character.
I have solved three crimes since this has happened. So it comes with some perks.
Matt would be happy to be your Dr. Watson.
I can handle that. So even though you're here in the city, we've never actually met. We've never hung out. This is truly the first time we've ever talked. And so we would love for you to share a bit about your history. Like, tell us about how you became a super saver, like when you're first starting out, because if I understand, you were making something like $40,000, you're living in New York, but you were investing a massive chunk of that. I'm assuming you weren't living large, so I want to kind of hear the Alan Corey origin story here.
Yeah, sure. So I moved to New York with dreams to be a comedy writer, and so to be a comedy writer, you basically have to be a stand-up comedian, and then hopefully you're funny enough that people hire you to write some jokes for them. So
Alan would be the next Liz Lemon, I'm guessing.
yes, exactly. And so, because in my head, I was like, entertainers are rich, and I had no entertaining skills. I'm not an actor or singer or dancer or anything like that. But I was like, well, I was class clown in high school. Maybe I can turn this into a lucrative side gig or a full-time gig. And so I moved to New York City. I found a tech support job. And this was the year 2000. It was the dot-com boom and everything right after that, actually. And I was like, let's live the fire life, the lean fire. This was before all that existed. But the cheapest place I could find was an illegal sublet in the Spanish Harlem project. So, I had a roommate who lived in the projects, and he gave me his room for $400 a month, which was great. And then I just started reducing my expenses everywhere. I'd save on food by going to the bodega in Spanish Harlem and buying ramen noodles for 13 cents each if I bought them in bulk.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And then I'd go to the bakery as they were closing and about to throw away all their fresh baked stuff for the day, and I'd get them at 50% off or sometimes free. And I would just try to cut all my expenses. And I even went to my HR person and said, listen, I want you to put 50% of my income or whatever, my take-home pay, into this bank account that I use every single day, and the other 50% in this one way across town that is really difficult for me to get to. And this was pre-online banking and all that as well. I mean, I'm not that ancient. I'm 45, but 20 years ago, this was
what
crazy.
What were the horse and carriages like in New York, Alan?
Yeah, exactly.
Life has changed a lot in the past 20, 25 years. True. But yeah. No, I honestly, just to interrupt for a second, I love that you set that barrier between you and your money to make it more difficult, because I assume you're socking that money away and hopefully you're planning to do something with it, right?
Yeah, well, so I felt like everyone in New York was wealthy. Like, you see the nice restaurants, you'd occasionally see a celebrity, and you see people driving and even taking cabs. I'm like, look at that rich person who can take a cab. and so I was like, how do they do it? And so I went to the library, because pre-podcast, pre-social media, pre-YouTube, all that stuff. And I just bought every book I could on wealth building and stocks and everything. And what I realized is with stocks, like I felt like I was gambling. It was like a 30-year horse race. But real estate, I felt like I could control it, and that I could, determine what I was going to buy, how much I was going to buy it for, how much I was going to put to renovate it, how much I could rent it for, what my financing terms are. I felt like I had a little bit more control, a lot more control, actually. And so I sort of reverse engineered that, I was burning the midnight oil, going, working my 9 to 5, And then I would go to the comedy club till 3 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't sustainable. It was terrible at both my day job and at comedy. But I was like, man, if I could just buy one piece of property a year for 5 years, then I could probably replace my day job income. And so that's where I went to that bank account that was collecting 50% of my take home pay every single year. And I would just say, whatever's in that, that would be my down payment for a property. And every year I would save 50%, and whatever's in that, you know, let's apply it to, and that was my get out of like corporate plan in 5 years. So that first year I had $10,000 saved up. It was right after 9/11. Everyone's trying to leave New York. You know, Alan, you're an idiot. You're trying to buy real estate. You know, everyone's so fearful. It's the worst time ever to ever buy real estate. You know, you don't know what you're doing. And I found one property that it was $100,000 in Brooklyn. I had never been to Brooklyn before. And I went to Brooklyn, and homeless people were right outside. All the stuff that you see in movies. And I was a naive kid from Georgia, but I was like, I got to buy it. This is the only property I can buy. It's a one bedroom apartment. And, you know, if things go bad, I'm back into the projects. Like, I'm already in the projects. Like, it can't get any worse. I'm sure. Fine living in the projects, whatever, right? Or I have tremendous upside if I can make this work like I thought it was going to work. And what I did is I bought it, and it was a big living room, and I was like, I'm not going to have any people over. I don't have any friends.
I'm working all the time.
Big, heavy. Yeah, exactly. In New York, no one ever goes to your apartment. You meet in a bar or a restaurant or everything. Like, you have no idea what people's lifestyle is, because they all live in Jersey and Brooklyn and Bronx or whatever. But I just took a big, heavy curtain and sectioned off the living room, and I rented that out to a friend of mine,
nice. You know,
another comedian. And that was like house hacking before house hacking existed. Yeah. And that would pay off my mortgage, right? So I went from paying $400 in the projects to paying nothing, and I own it.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, there's something to this, right? And then the next year I was able to save up $15,000 on January 1st. And so then I bought a duplex. And then I just, you know, saved up some more money. And my third property, I did a flip, and I didn't have enough money, but I found the deal. And I found my next door neighbor was a contractor, and he would work for free for equity. And then the only person that I thought was rich or knew was, I was dating a girl at the time, and her dad was a lawyer. And I was like, well, he must be rich. He has a job in New York City. He's a lawyer in New York City. He must be rich. So I asked him if he would pay for the down payment and 20% down on the renovations here, on this deal that I found. And he said, sure. And we bought this property in Red Hook, Brooklyn, which at the time no one knew anything about, for $400,000. We put $200,000 into it, and we sold it for $1.1 million a year later. I was 25 years old at that time, and the buyer was Barbara Corcoran from Shark Tank.
Oh, wow.
And that gave me the boost of confidence, like, wow, okay, I found a deal, I renovated it, and the queen of New York City real estate bought it for her own personal investment. I'm doing things right. And then I was like, all right, I don't need to do comedy anymore. Let me lean and do real estate full time.
That's cool. Well, I love that combo of like early sacrifices. I think there's a lot of stuff that we can glean from that. The fact that you're kind of divorcing yourself from that money until you're ready to invest it.
I love that.
Yeah, you're siphoning it off elsewhere, so it's not a temptation for you. We want to talk a lot more about investing on this episode, but you're not just an investor, you're also an agent. And so in spring is just the hottest time for the housing market. What are you seeing right now? I'm curious, because there's a lot of our listeners are interested in buying a house. Maybe they've put it off because what's happened over the past couple of years with rates and prices. Are you starting to see things moderate, things chill out a little bit in the housing market? I'm curious to hear your perspective.
Yeah. So you're not going to like this, or your listeners are not going to like this, but it's hot and everything's a bidding war. If you have a property that doesn't need any work, it's going to go under contract with multiple offers, and there's not going to be comps that support it. The data just doesn't make sense. But that's what's happening. Why is that happening? We have a housing shortage. Has the housing shortage improved since last year? No. The year before that? No. The year before that? No. We are 20 years behind on building to match the demand. That makes prices go up, regardless of the interest rates. People want to wait, and they're going to wait. Oh, let me save up $20,000. You know, I don't like the homes that I see right now. If I save another $20,000, I can go up price point. I can move my budget from $500,000 to $550,000. It doesn't work that way with inflation and the housing demand. When you save up $20,000, that house you looked at, $500,000, is now $550,000. You're just buying the exact same house a year later for more expensive price. And so you can't outsave inflation. And, you know, so you have money in your bank, but inflation is eating away at that. And you're trying to outsave it. You're trying to outsave the rising housing market. It's one of those things where it's never a good time to buy real estate, in that if you're waiting for the perfect scenario of interest rates and price point and what you get, combined with, it's always a good time to buy real estate because tomorrow is always going to be worse than it is today. You know, every real estate investor, everyone who's ever bought a house, they're always like, wow, I'm glad I bought 2 years ago. You know, ask them, you know, I've been in real estate for 25 years. Every single person's like, man, I should have bought 2 years ago. There's just not enough homes to buy. And so it's tough. And so there's two ways to look at real estate, is whether you're looking at it as an investment or a primary residence. But a primary, it's an emotional decision. Sometimes, many times, the numbers don't make sense in terms of an investment, but you're buying for lifestyle. You want to be close to your work or school district, or you just like the walkability, or close to the interstate, whatever it is. That's fine. You can pay extra and pay a premium for those things because that's for your lifestyle and that brings you happiness. But you can't always look at your primary resident is going to be the best investment for you. And real estate investors look at property differently. They look at it as a spreadsheet decision, totally, not an investment decision. And so they might like the uglier house or the one that's in the floodplain. And I always like to say, you want to buy you want your house to be ugly in the street and sexy in the spreadsheets. And so that's what makes a good investment. And typically the opposite is true for primary, where it's sexy in the street, but ugly in the spreadsheet.
Yeah, you want it to have that curb appeal, something that, yeah, your family's excited to come home to. But so, I mean, and I totally agree with what you're saying as far as the overall trend of real estate. I mean, it's one of those things that continues. It's almost like the stock market in that way. Like, yes, there are little fluctuations here and there, but generally speaking, it's up and to the right. But mortgage rates are crazy high compared to where they were years ago, and they have a massive impact on your monthly payment. It has a huge impact on individuals' ability to afford a home or not. And so I'm curious, like, I know it depends on from market to market, but how have you seen folks cope with that? And I'll say where we are, we're not down in the city, in the small neighborhoods around central Atlanta like you are, but we are seeing things slow down a good bit here. There is not as much mobility because it seems like a lot of folks are locked in. They've got folks are hanging on to the 3% mortgages because they're seeing what moving to something at 6.5% and 7%, what that's going to do to their payment.
Yeah, that's adding to the housing shortage, right? But people don't want to sell because they have a 3% mortgage, or if they do need to move because of a birth in the family or a death or a marriage or a job transfer, they'll keep that as a rental because the interest rate's so low. And so that adds to the housing shortage. But if you have to move, right, you have to get into the school district, you do get a job transfer, you got married or whatever it is, you have to move, you have like 10 choices to choose from within your buy box, whether that's your zip code and your price, right? And so then that's where these bidding wars go nuts, because you have to move. You don't have a choice. A real estate investor doesn't think that way. A real estate investor will buy and get a 30-year fixed and hold it until it's the right time to sell. For instance, I invested all through the real estate, the great financial crash, and my property value went down 50%, but I wasn't selling. And when people aren't buying homes, that actually increases the rental demand. There's actually more renters because they're not interested in buying homes because the lenders aren't, the banks aren't giving money, or the interest rates are so high. So there's actually more renters. And then even though my property value went down, I'm not selling. I'm just waiting and renting it out and collecting cash flow month to month until it is a good time to sell. Back when interest rates are low again, or there's, you know, high demand and I can sell it, there's been a lot of appreciation on my property, then I sell it. So that's what's great about real estate investing, is you don't time the market. You just wait out the market until you want to sell. But primary investing is, you hear the horror stories and they make the headlines because they're just time, you know, independent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really important. Actually, I think your history owning rental real estate through the Great Recession, because you can ride it out. If if you have a long enough time horizon, and if you have enough cash reserves. I want to know too, like, let's pivot, let's specifically talk about real estate investing. Like, what's your philosophy there? Do you think of it more like buying a small business, right? And then how do you talk to people who are like, I'm interested, I'm curious about real estate investing, but I'm not sure if it is for me. Maybe I'm not quite as gung-ho as you are, Alan. Maybe I should keep going with the 401k and the Roth IRA, kind of like Matt and Joel talk about too. Why, like, what do you tell folks when they're kind of debating the two?
Yeah, so the number one way to get wealthy, like really, really wealthy, is through leverage. Leverage is borrowing money and making more money with that money. That's what a mortgage does. You can't buy stocks with mortgage. It's very safe. Every investment is a mix of, you know, the riskier it is, the more money you make. But what's great about real estate, I think, is actually safer than stocks. And you make 5 times as much money as stocks. So for instance, let's say you have $100,000 and you buy $100,000 in stocks. One company. And it goes under, you lose $100,000. You can also buy $100,000 of a house, right? Buy one house for $100,000. It can be out of state or whatnot. Property manager in a rural town where homes may be more affordable than where you live. And you're making $1,000 a month in income. And then let's say you take that $100,000, you know, you rent it out for $1,000. And you know, let's assume after all expenses, you're taking home $1,000. Now, if that burns to the ground, okay, well, I could still sell the land, right? The lot's probably $20,000. You can't do that with stocks. So in some ways, you're a little bit protected. But I like to take a mutual fund approach to real estate similar to the stocks. You wouldn't put $100,000 in stocks. You would probably spread it around in a mutual fund, which buys hundreds of bunches of different stocks. I do the same thing. Let me take that $100,000 and let me put it as 5 different down payments on 5 different $100,000 homes, $20,000 a year, $20,000 a year, $20,000, $20,000, $20,000. And now I have a mutual fund of houses. So what's great about that is if one burns down to the ground, you know, let's say after mortgage, I'm making $200. I'm still making $1,000 a month. One burns to the ground. Oh, well, I'm making $800 a month, right?
In that scenario, let's hope you have insurance too.
Yeah. You have insurance. Yeah, if you have a mortgage, you have to have insurance. So let's maybe don't be so drastic. If I have one house, let's say I raise the rent $50. Great, I'm making $1,050 a month. But if I have 5 houses and they're all exactly the same and I raise the rent $50 over time because of inflation or whatever, well, now I'm making $250 a month. I've scaled my wealth up, right? If I do nothing and I never raise rent and just wait 30 years, if I have one house in 30 years, maybe that $100,000 house is let's say $175,000 house. But if I have 5, I have 5 houses that are paid off that are $175,000. So that's 5X my wealth, and if 5X my rental income, if I raise rent $25,000, if one goes down, if one is vacant, maybe doesn't burn to the ground, I just can't rent it or whatnot, then the other 4 buoy it like a mutual fund. And then I say every house comes with a lottery ticket, a hidden lottery ticket. I was investing in Brooklyn and different neighborhoods in Brooklyn, and all of a sudden Brooklyn blew up and became the next hot neighborhood, not because of anything I was doing, not because I had any foresight or I was smart or trying to time the market. But if I had one property and I kept trying to pay off that mortgage and I wasn't trying to scale and leverage and buy more properties, I wouldn't have gotten quote unquote lucky. And so there's all these things that sort of happen if you borrow money and you put it to go make more money. And the more properties you buy, the less risky it is, and the luckier you get, and the more money you're going to make.
Sure. So yeah, the mechanics behind it certainly makes sense. But do you think that this is something that everyone out there should consider? Like, should everyone out there own rental real estate? Because it's, when you are just looking at the numbers, you're like, oh man, who wouldn't do that with, say, a spare $20,000, which I'm not sure if anyone has a spare $20,000 sitting around. But even,
well, and I'm not sure houses cost $100,000 these days. But
and so I guess with all that in mind, like, there's an element of time that's required to manage these as well. It's got like a part-time job element to it. It's not nearly as passive as a lot of real estate influencers want to make it sound. And whether it's managing renovations, showing the property, screening tenants, I guess, what would you say to somebody who is assuming that it's going to be a set it and forget it kind of deal?
It wasn't ever a set it, forget it until you get to a certain scale. And when you have, you know, you can get property managers, you can find $100,000 properties. I mean, as of 4 years ago, I was buying properties for $30,000 just an hour south of Atlanta in a town called Griffin, Georgia. And I recently sold them all for $60,000 each 2 years ago. And they're probably $80,000 to $100,000 now. So they exist. They just might not exist in your hometown. And you're not looking for them, so you don't really see them because they're not in your neighborhood. But what I would say is, yes, it's going to take a little bit of work. It's leveraged work. You're going to have to leverage and build the connections, build a network. I always say find a rock star in the town you want to invest in, whether that's a rock star agent, a rock star property manager, a rock star lender, because rock stars hang out with other rock stars, and you just leverage their network and say, hey, I want to invest in real estate in this town. You're a rock star in this town. Can you help connect me to the other players? And you can just leverage their network. It's much easier to do it that way. But if you have $20,000, This is my sort of approach in my book, House Fire, where it's, should everyone do this? And it's like, well, if you like math, you should do it. If you trust math, you should do it. Because I look at my internet bill, and my internet phone bill combined is $150 a month. And if I follow typical FIRE movement, which is FIRE, you know, financial independence, retire early. I know you've talked about this plenty of times in your podcast. It says it takes 25 times your annual expenses of that bill. And as long as you have that in stocks and you withdraw 4% each year, then you've got that covered. And so that would be, let's see, mm-hmm. $150 bill would be $1,800 a year, $45,000 in stocks. And as long as I have $45,000 in stocks, I can pull out 4% of that, which is $150 a month. And that internet bill is paid for my life. That sounds crazy to me. Like, yeah, of course, if I do that for every bill in my life, I have to be a millionaire. And that just seems too ambitious. I will never get there. And then I'm living on a constrained retirement. So instead, I was like, how can I apply this to real estate, this FIRE method? Because I'm not doing that. I'm done living below my means. I did that in my early 20s. I'm not going to do that anymore. What I took was half of that. So $45,000, half of that's $22,500. I went and bought these $100,000 properties, fewer than $100,000 properties. I built up a portfolio of 50 single-family homes, all under $100,000. And what I realized is if I put down 20% on a $100,000 property, and then there was $2,500 of closing costs, that was my $22,500, I could cash flow after expenses, property manager, vacancies, CapEx repairs, like a big roof and things like that, I could cash flow $150. So all of a sudden, I have right away, I don't have to wait until I save $45,000 and withdraw 4%. I took $22,500, put it in the market, and it would kick off $150 to pay my internet phone bill. And I was like, aha, that was my aha moment. And so then I went down to my next bill. Wow, if I collect all my utility bills, my gas and electric, you know, that's probably $150 there. Okay, I just need to save another $22,500. And then that's going to pay off my bill. And then I just started matching my houses for each bill. And then that's my house fire method. And I would just, this house for that bill, that bill, that bill. And that is my retirement plan. And what was great now is that I live larger and larger each year in my retirement because rent goes up. You charge a little bit more in rent. My mortgage payments go down a little bit. I still get great tax breaks and the properties are appreciating more and more. So I'm not pulling 4% from my stock, keeping that at a, you know, artificially low level because as you withdraw money from your stocks, it can't appreciate as much. I'm not pulling any money from my real estate except for the cash flow. And so this is the retirement plan that takes half the time, half the money, and I get to live larger and larger each time in retirement. It just makes sense to me. So yes, I think everyone should do it. If you like math, if you're willing to put some upfront work, it really only takes 5 properties over 5 years. And that's better than working at your day job for another 15, 20 years to retire.
I love how you said you have to like math, and you're like, wait a second, no. You have to trust math. And because I don't really like math, but I trust math. And so there's a difference there for me. And I think maybe for a lot of people out there who are like, yeah, no, algebra wasn't really my thing, but I trust the math. I trust the way some of the basic numbers work. And so I too can get behind the idea of investing in real estate. But we've got more questions to get to with you, Alan, specifically about your house fire method, how it works. There's a lot of details we want to unearth. We'll get to those questions right after this. Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's Cachava.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week
at the beach.
Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, we are back from the break talking with Alan Corey about investing in real estate, specifically real estate FIRE, achieving a sense of financial independence via real estate. And Alan, I'm having a hard time, I guess, getting past the just where mortgage interest rates are right now. And given the fact that they are higher and that most folks are likely looking to the banks in order to finance their properties, how are you approaching that, I guess? Because obviously, when you're paying 3.5%, your numbers look one way.
But a lot better.
If you're paying 6.5% to 7.5% on an investment property, it's going to have an impact on the numbers. You're mentioning the math right before the break. Talk to us about the math behind where rates are right now, and specifically from an investor's standpoint.
So, as an investor, I completely don't care about interest rates. Let me explain that, because you're going to be scratching your head. Here's what matters. I've found great real estate deals that would be great to even good with 20% interest rates. I found terrible real estate deals that would be terrible even with 0% interest rates. It's just a variable. You plug it into a formula, it's a variable. It's just like the purchase price. I look at it this way. If with today's rates, let's say it's a 7%, 8%, or if I'm doing hard money, I got to do 10, 15%, whatever it is, you put it in your spreadsheet and you look at the numbers, and if it's cash flowing, I've got three things that are going to happen. Like, I only get fixed debt. You won't get in trouble with fixed rate debt, meaning 30 years fixed. Every time there's a crash, the commercial people right now, offices, it's because they have adjustable rate mortgages. Back in the crash of 2008, it's because of adjustable rate mortgages. If you have 30 year fixes, you're golden, and you'll just get rich by longevity. And so the three things that are going to happen are this. I lock in a 10% interest rate. In 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, interest rates stay the same and it never moves off 10%. That's fine. I'm still cash flowing. I'm making money each month. This is a little ATM machine for me. So I'm glad I bought and that I didn't wait for interest rates to change. Or interest rates go up. And, the day after I close, interest rates go up to 12% and forever, and they never go back down to 10%. Well, that's fine. I've locked in at 10%. I'm glad I bought. Third thing, interest rates go down. Well, I'm making money right now. If interest rates go down to 8 or 7, then I refinance. I'm glad I bought. So that's how real estate investors look at it, is they're not going to buy anything that's not making money in today's environment, in today's prices, in today's interest rates. But if you buy a residential property, which is 4 units or fewer, with a 30-year fixed loan, you can find a way to cash flow it today with the numbers, I don't care about interest rates. I can either stay locked in or I refinance if they get better. Like, I'm just glad I bought, because I'm trying to buy a property to pay my bills, that $150 here, $200 here, trying to buy the car, pay off my car note, my student loan debt. That's what I'm using my real estate for. I'm not trying to flip it. I'm not trying to sell it. So that's why I say it's irrelevant what the interest rates are.
Okay, talk to me about how you determine what's a good deal and what's worth investing in. Because it can't just be, oh, it's cash flowing $2 a month, because then you're like, yeah, it's not worth my time, right? So like your philosophy is always be buying, but you also don't seem to put as much emphasis on finding the property with the absolute best returns. And my thought is fewer better properties maybe means less hassle with the same amount of income. But I'm curious to hear your philosophy.
Yeah, this is where everyone freezes. The analysis paralysis. They'll create their buy box. You have to create a buy box, because what happens is someone's going to say, well, I found this Airbnb in Florida. I found this duplex in my hometown. And then I found this single family home in my neighborhood. And they'll come to me and say, which one should I buy? I'll typically say, well, if you found the best duplex in your old hometown, and you found the best single family, and you bought the best, you know, short-term rental because you've been looking there, then buy them all. You can't really compare and contrast. And what I say is you don't have a buy box that's strict enough. It's much easier to narrow that buy box and only look at the duplexes from your own old hometown. Why is that? Because then you could become an expert, and you're going to get the word out there that, hey, Alan buys duplexes in his own hometown, and then everyone knows to call you if there's a duplex, and you just buy duplex, and all of a sudden you are a market expert. You know what a duplex rents for, how much it costs to renovate, what the property taxes are going to be, the insurance. And so if you sort of concentrate and become an expert in one niche, rather than trying to diversify off the gate, you are going to go much further, and you're going to learn more.
And that's exactly what you did with quadplexes, yeah. Right? Like, you were the quadplex guy.
Yeah, I learned this. It wasn't any foresight. I just bought one, and then I bought another one, and then the neighbors come, and they're like, well, hey, you bought two in the street. You want to buy this one? And all of a sudden, I became the duplex guy. It's just your reputation becomes a lead magnet, and I become an expert. Obviously, I'm not going to make a ton that first. I'm going to learn a lot of lessons on that first one, but then I can apply it to the second one and third one, and then you become an expert in that niche. So if you want to hone the skill set without buying anything, I realized I was doing this when I lived in Brooklyn. I went to every single open house on my block, and I would just track every sale on my block. And then I would predict what I think it would sell for and whatnot. And then I would predict what I think it should list for. And I just tracked my block. And once I sort of was like within 5% of getting it right every single time, then I went to my street, and then I went to my zip code, and then I went to the school district or whatever. You just widen it. And I just started tracking numbers and data. It's fun for me. And I was just looking at it on Zillow, like everyone looks at Zillow. I hate math. I'm not a big math guy, but real estate math is just addition and subtraction. It's not anything to, you don't have to have a degree in. It's great. If you have a passion and you can hear my passion, people call me after this podcast, Alan, let's buy real estate together. Can you help me? Like, you just got to get your word out and share your passion, and it'll change your life.
I like what you were talking about there with kind of zeroing down into street level. And that's kind of where I started too, was like investing all inside of a neighborhood. And then I was like, wait a second, I can invest in the neighborhood over, and maybe the neighborhood over from that. But it was all kind of within this limited sphere, all within kind of driving distance and my ability to thoroughly understand a market. You've now invested in a bunch of different markets. You've invested in New York, you've invested in Atlanta, you've invested in South Georgia, you've invested in different kinds of properties too. How do you think, is that just like, do you grow that over time? And how important is it maybe to start off with a, like a niche inside of a particular neighborhood or small geographic location, so you can kind of become an expert before you expand?
Do as I say, not as I do. Definitely you want that niche. The reason I sort of kind of go all over is twofold. One, I have ADHD, but two, I'm a realtor, and people are, will come to me and say, hey, I want to buy a short-term rental. Hey, Alan, I want to buy a duplex. I want to buy an apartment building. And I don't feel comfortable giving advice unless I'm doing that too. Like who am I to give you advice on short-term rental unless I'm doing it? So I'm going to go buy a short-term rental. I'm going to learn the ropes so that I can teach those to my clients. I also teach real estate investing as well and written books and stuff. So I whatever people want to buy, I want to go buy it along with them or before them so that I can be a better guide to them on their investment. It's all sort of fun to me. I always say there's a million ways to make real estate, a million ways to make $1 million in real estate. Just pick one. Like you can be the only buy condos or only buy townhouses or only buy single families, but you want to accelerate your path to expertise. And if you just rinse and repeat and get those reps in, that's how you become it. Don't get distracted by all the noise, the new shiny thing. Like obviously when I started, Airbnb didn't even exist. And so that's a new product. I don't know, there'll be there's PadSplit out there right now where you can rent by the room, a single family house, but you're renting by the room instead of renting it out. Like there's always gonna be new products. I don't care which one you choose, pick one. I just highly recommend that you stay at four units or fewer, that small multifamily, because you can get that 30-year fix, which I love. And if you can buy a duplex, triplex, or quad, I love that much more better than buying four single-family homes, because then I only have one roof to worry about instead of four roofs. I only have one property tax bill instead of four. I only have one pest control bill instead of four. You can scale down all your expenses if you can kind of condense it in that small multifamily.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. So speaking of, we're going to take a break here in a minute, and I think we're going to get to maybe like a bunch more rapid-fire style questions with you, Alan, about real estate. But I'm curious. I want to follow up about the houses that you mentioned down in Griffin. You said that you actually sold those properties. It sounded like you held onto those for a couple of years. The way I approach the properties I own, I'm planning to keep them forever. And so for you, when it does come time to sell, what's the trigger? What is it that makes you say, all right, it's time to list these properties?
Yeah, well, it's just what I just explained, why I had 50 pest control bills. I had 50, 50 of everything.
Too many.
And so, yeah, too many.
Okay.
And in two and a half, so I bought the entire portfolio. Roughly each house was $30,000 each. And I know whatever you're visioning in your mind, what a $30,000 house bought you 5 years ago, hours south of Atlanta, like people were paying $600-$700, and then they're very livable properties. These were fine, and mostly Section 8, so they're guaranteed income. The government's going to pay for it. Tenants that have been there for 20 or 30 years. And so if I've lost you when you say, you bought a $1.5 million portfolio. I didn't have money to buy this property, but the seller was a retired real estate investor. His kids didn't want these properties. And he was having trouble selling them because at the time there wasn't a ton of loan products for large single family portfolios like there is now. And so I went to him and said, hey, I want to buy this. And I'll buy them all, but I can't get a loan for it. But no one can get a loan for this because who's going to get 50 different mortgages? Like it's just not going to make sense. So we agreed on a seller financing deal, which means he was my mortgagee. He had all these properties paid off, so I only had to put $100,000 down. Again, I got another partner. I put in $50,000. My partner put in $50,000, and we got a 15-year mortgage at 7.5% interest rate. You know, 5 years ago, that was crazy because everyone was getting 2% and 3% interest rates, but I only have to put 10% down on a 50 home portfolio, and it cash flowed even at a 15-year note. It covered all that, and on top of that, it would kick off about $8,000 to $10,000 a month, and we just took that money and put it back into the properties, fixed them up. There's a lot of deferred maintenance. We didn't pull any of that money out. And then eventually I bought my partner out because he wanted to go do other investments. Real estate wasn't his thing. And then I ended up selling that property 2.5 later as a whole portfolio for $2.5 million. So with I turned $100,000 in 2.5 years into a $1 million profit. And so that was one of those things where I wanted to turn that into an apartment building. It makes much more sense to take those 50 single family homes and buy a 20 unit apartment building because then I only have to go to one address instead of 50. Yeah. It's much easier to property manage. It's so much easier to manage when it's all under one roof,
sure,
rather than spread across an entire zip code.
Yeah, sure. Well, they may not want to start. That might not be your first purchase is the 20-unit apartment complex, but you scaled up. You
commercial residential may not be the first thing that somebody wants to dip their toes in the water.
You gain the skills, and you'd also gain the financial ability based on appreciation of your other properties and the smart moves you'd made to then go into that endeavor.
Yeah. Well, and what you laid out here, Alan, is a perfect example of, I love how what you said it kind of quickly, but at the time, the rate that you're paying to this owner was ludicrous. So much higher than what anybody else out there was paying. But for you, you crunched the numbers and you were able to see, well, man, we're making money, but times 50, we're really making money.
Yeah.
And for you, it made a ton of sense and ended up working out for not only you, but you and your partner. But, you know, just a second ago, you also mentioned Airbnb, how it's a new product and how that has an impact on real estate. So we've got a few more questions about that, plus more. We'll get to all of that right after this.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the a.m. in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back. You're still listening to Real Estate Fire, a conversation with Alan Corey about investing in real estate to boost your ability to retire early, to reach financial independence. And Alan, man, I so appreciate all the great information you've brought already. Let's get to a bunch of like quicker questions because there's just so much more we want to cover and we just don't have forever. But like one of the things I want to talk about, you're against paying off mortgages, you say. You call it the dumbest thing a person can possibly do. But that is that flies in the face of so much traditional personal finance advice. Why are you a fan of people holding onto their mortgages as long as possible?
Okay, I'll try to make this short. Imagine you found a dollar in the parking lot And in the gas station parking lot, you have two choices. You can go mail that dollar in to your mortgage note, pay off a dollar of your principal, or you can walk into the gas station and buy a $1 Snickers bar. You have that life decision. A lot of people who have extra money, they're going to throw it to their principal mortgage and pay it off. Now, let's say you left that dollar there and you came back 15 years later and that dollar was still there and you're like, fine, no one's going to pick this up. I'm going to pick it up. Then what's going to happen is you have two choices. You're going to have that same dilemma. I can either mail it into my mortgage lender and get another dollar off my principal payment like you could have done 15 years earlier, or you can walk into the gas station and try to buy a Snickers bar, and guess what? Your Snickers bar is now $3 thanks to inflation. So what does that tell you? Well, that tells you that everything around you is going to get more and more expensive over time, except your mortgage. Your mortgage is the only thing that's going to stay the same or it's feel like it's in. Getting cheaper. So why do you want to get rid of the best benefit in the world where you've locked in the most expense in your life for 30-year mortgage, whether it's your investment or your primary, is probably the most expensive expense. You can lock that in for 30 years. Everything else is going to get more expensive. You know, just look at your grandparents or your parents who bought 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and they have like a $1,000 mortgage payment. And they look like geniuses. They did nothing except wait and not pay off their mortgage. So it's such a huge benefit. I just don't understand the rush to pay it off.
People have that emotional, psychological aversion to debt. Unfortunately, not all debt is created equal. But Alan, what do you say to folks who are trying to limit the amount of risk when it comes to their different properties? Like, we get the question about if folks should incorporate, if each property should be owned by its own LLC. Like, that's one path you can go. Or another path is umbrella insurance to cover you as an owner. Where do you come down on that debate?
Yeah, umbrella is great. I don't think you need an LLC unless you have over 10 properties. Or if you get to the point where your debt to income ratio, DTI, which is sort of how you get residential mortgages in your name, they look at this formula, how much is your debt to your income? If that's out of whack, it's more than 50%, you can't get any residential mortgages anymore, then you got to get an LLC in commercial. But if you're worried about getting sued, guess who gets sued? It's the people who have a paid off property. Let's say you have a $1 million property that's paid off and someone breaks their foot or whatever, they're going to sue the person as a $1 million asset, force you to sell that asset. But if you have a $1 million property with a $900,000 mortgage, the attorneys are like, it's not worth suing them because by the time they sell it with realtor commissions, you're not going to get any money. So
not paying off the mortgage and 100%. Keeping that loan around as long as possible.
Yeah, I've got 50 arguments for that. Yes, exactly. That's
one. All right, talk to me about hiring a property manager versus self-managing. I'm a big fan of at least starting off managing the property yourself so you're learning the ropes. And then maybe down the line, especially as that property becomes more profitable, maybe you can add that as a line item and take that off your plate, especially as you're kind of growing your real estate portfolio. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I tell people, manage your first five. Hopefully they're local and is drivable. If not, your town, the numbers just don't make sense for any good investment, then yeah, you're going to have to use a property manager, and that's fine. But find a property manager and then invest within their skill set. Well, you know, are they Section 8? Are they luxury housing? Are they a certain part of the neighborhood? Understand who's going to manage it and make sure that they can keep an eye on it. Try to get rid of the busy work. If you find it that it just becomes busy work for you, get a property manager, and you know, whether you want to go buy more real estate or look for more deals, or you can now go do a hobby and your real estate's paying for that hobby, or maybe you can work extra hours in another, you know, side gig or something. That's what the beauty about real estate, it gives you options.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talk about vacation rentals. Joel and I, our families, we vacation every summer. We go to the beach. And a lot of times when you go to the beach or wherever you go off to,
you start dreaming.
Yeah. You start walking around. You're like, oh, wouldn't it be awesome? What if we could just come here every other month, to our own place? But at the same time, I start to think through maybe the pain in the butt that might be, especially if you're trying to manage a vacation rental. But what are your thoughts on investment properties that are vacation rentals?
Yeah, it's similar to long-term rentals. I usually say you don't want to invest in properties that you want to live in, because then you're making your own biases and emotional decisions over a spreadsheet decision. A lot of people want to buy that beach house that they go to every single year on 4th of July, and then what they don't realize is 4th of July is when you can make the most money out of it. So
that's true.
You're going to be staying in it and not be able to make the most money out of it. And then when you don't go, that's when no one wants to rent it, because in the off season, you can't, you know, you're renting it for pennies, and then you find yourself.
Sorry, you're going to the beach in January now.
Yeah, exactly. So you're now altering your lifestyle to make sense of this investment. You go in the off season, or you don't go on the best week of the year. So I don't like mixing business and pleasure. I do like investing in sort of big cities. I've got some in Atlanta. I like sort of the sub-tier touristy markets. So maybe not Disneyland, but maybe a 2 hours from Disneyland. There's a bunch of beaches in Florida. You don't have the big corporations that are going to invest there. You don't have the hotel districts fighting you, and then the Airbnb laws as much. Things are much cheaper. People will come and stay for a week. If it's sort of a destination rather than a weekend pop-in kind of thing, and it's probably not something where I would want to go to every single. You know, I'll go once every now and then because it's a small sleepy beach town or something, but I'm not going there, religiously with the whole family kind of thing.
Sure. Talk to us about scaling, because you have scaled. I think you said you had like 350 doors. Is that about where you're at now?
Yes. So I've got about 20 doors in my name, and then the rest was through partners. So
I want to know, though, when you stop. Like, what makes you quit? Because at what point is it enough? And like our friend Chad Carson talks about basically the small and mighty real estate investor, which is, hey, 10 paid off units at some point is going to be able to fund more than enough for the lifestyle you want. When do you know? When do you stop evaluating properties? When do you stop investing? When do you say enough's enough? I've crushed it and I'm going to be more leisurely.
I've got 350 doors, but it's fun for me. It doesn't feel like work. I've got a lot of people who want to invest with me, or they find a deal and they say, Alan, how can we get this done? I've achieved a lot through real estate, but it's not like, oh, I'm going to get happier if I have more, It's just, I like treasure hunting. I'm like the guy on the beach with the, the electrical thing. What's that called?
The metal detector scanning the sand.
Right? Yeah. Like that, is that guy's life going to change if it finds a wedding band? No, it's just fun and entertaining for him. And that's me in real estate. It's fun to look at opportunities. Oh, this is an opportunity, guys. You guys want to pass around out and get this done? Or should I buy this myself? Like I enjoy it. It's my hobby,
I love it. Obviously, I think there's a lot of folks who are just like, man, I've got a job that I took so that I can pay the bills. I don't enjoy my work, but the ability, that's something over time that you do want to set your sights on, the kind of work that's going to be fulfilling, the kind of work that's going to be able to allow you to at some point achieve some sense of financial freedom. But I love that. And the value that you're able to put out into the world through the work that you do it's a huge part of life fulfillment. And I think our opinions of retirement has even changed over the years.
Yeah.
Joel and I, as this is something that we've talked about a lot, but you mentioned Airbnb earlier, Alan. With that being a platform that can change the rules, and not only what, say, Airbnb charges folks, what they charge hosts, but even cities, and how there's a lot of cities that are clamping down on short-term rentals, how much should investors take that into account as they're looking to buy a property?
Yeah, you should take into account in that never buy a vacation rental that won't cash flow as a long-term rental. So if the laws change, you can just pivot it into a long-term rental and you're still cash flowing. So you run your numbers twice. You run first as a long-term rental. And if it makes sense as a long-term rental, if that day ever comes, whether it's tomorrow or 10 years from now, that's your pivot point. I always love properties that have pivots. The more pivots you have, the better. And so you can say, well, I'll make four times as much money as a short-term rental. And if they change the laws on me, I'll still make money. I'm not losing money as a long-term rental.
Yep.
That's how you go about it.
I love that. It's a little more conservative in nature too. Just making sure that, because that's happened. I had a friend who bought one in Chattanooga, and then Chattanooga says, wait, no more short-term rentals here, at least for the time being. And so he's kind of halted for a minute, at least from buying more. He's able to still, he's grandfathered in for the one he's got, but that can be a really tough position to find yourself in. But Alan, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. Where can our listeners find out more about you, more about your house fire method?
Yeah, sure. I'm a real estate maximalist, so you can find me on social media at Real Estate Maxi. Also, I teach real estate investing at House Money Media, and we have a podcast called the House Money Real Estate Investing Podcast. So all those channels would be great.
Awesome. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us.
Thanks, guys. It's been a blast.
All right, man. That was a good convo. A lot of interesting information, obviously, from someone who's who's rabid, all in on real estate. And so it's just nice to pick his brain as someone who I think is we like real estate. You kind of like set it up nicely at the beginning of the episode. It's like
we're not Alan Rabid Dog Corey though,
right? Yeah, no, but I did appreciate his insights. I think there's a lot that some people who are interested in investing in real estate can learn from Alan and from this episode. What was your big takeaway though from this combo?
I think my big takeaway is influenced by the fact that I don't want to alienate folks who are listening to this and they're just like, 350 doors, what the, like, I'm never gonna do that. And so I'm gonna take it back to personal finance. And at the beginning, because I think there's a lot of folks who are saying, well, yeah, if I had that much money on hand, sure, if I could go to a hard money lender and drop $100,000, like, there's a lot of if onlys. And the fact is, Alan got to that point by working his butt off when he was up in New York, and he was setting aside 50% of his paycheck, man.
And it wasn't a big paycheck.
It wasn't a bunch, but that percentage, think about what folks could do right now who are in their 20s if they set aside 50% of their paycheck for a short period of time. I'm not saying that you have to do this indefinitely, but the ability to do that for a short period of time to achieve some very quantifiable, measurable goals. Well, if you want something bad enough, that is what it takes. And by doing that, you can achieve something as massive as what Alan has been able to do.
When he was describing that, all I could think was front-loading the sacrifice, which is what Dachi talks about. And that's exactly what he was doing. He was saying, like, listen, I'm going to go the opposite of hog wild right now. I'm going to cut to the bone just for a few years so that I can build up this nest egg. And then, boom, I'm going to make an investment or two. And then eventually I'll be able to inflate my lifestyle. He's not eating ramen every night now.
He was back then, 13 cents a packet.
Think about how many fancy tweed hats he has now. I mean, like, come on, he would not have imagined that back then.
That's right.
But I appreciate that it's like, for a period of time, I'm willing to do this and sacrifice even more than I want to do in the future. But it's because I'm preparing that future for myself. And I think it's a good way of looking at it.
Totally. Yeah. What about you? What was your big takeaway though?
So I like when he said, get reps in. And you get better with things over time. I remember, man, being so freaking scared renting out my first property. And then the second one, I was still pretty nervous, but not nearly as frightened. And then over time, you're like, wait a second.
Gaining some of that confidence.
Yeah. Now, I think part of the reason he's so gung-ho on it is because he's been doing it so long. He's been so successful. He's made so many good deals. And over time, and he's learned from the bad ones too. And so you just kind of, then you begin to know what to look out for, the fine print to watch out for, maybe how to screen tenants even better. And you it becomes this well-oiled machine, but it involves getting reps. You just don't get better by sitting on the sidelines and consuming information in the same way you do by getting in there and trying the whole man in the arena thing, I guess, right? But so it's obviously important to do your due diligence and know the market in and out that you want to invest in, kind of like he was actually talking about too. But then it's important to get in there and actually do the thing, start off small, self-manage, learn as you're doing, and the more reps you get in, the better you're going to get at it.
Yeah, I think that's when he was talking about finding a specialty and focusing, like, laser focus, because I think that's so important as well.
Yeah.
Not only getting the reps in, massive number of reps, but really narrowing in on what it is that you're going to specialize in. But our beer, Joel, that you and I enjoyed today was an Oost. I wanted to say that. That's what it's called. An OOST, Oost. This is another one by High Grain Brewing Company, and it was donated by Mike and Christy. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I like this one. It had like caramel vibes, some figgy notes. I thought it was smooth and warming.
It was definitely warming.
Yeah.
So there's no joke. It's a strong ale. So this is a 10%er, and you could pick up on some of that pepperiness that came from that, that higher gravity, but it almost had like a clove-like pepperiness to it because of that higher ABV, while still maintaining its like Belgian banana-y like sweetness that you get from Belgian golden strong ales like this. But is it Monkey? What's the Victory? Golden Monkey?
I feel like I haven't had that in years.
Me neither. I think that was my first golden strong ale.
Okay. But I mean, that was a classic back in the day, but I don't think I've had a Victory beer in forever.
It's been a minute. Yeah. But Mike and Chrissy, thank y'all again for sending this one plus the others our way.
For sure. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll have links up in the show notes to help you if you're interested in investing in real estate. So please do check those out. But Matt, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out. Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night.
Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We're talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.